president will not tolerate attacks on American troops, and neither will I.
The Biden administration promises a strong response to the enemy drone strike in Jordan that claimed the lives of three American soldiers.
And I noticed his hands were shaking, and I thought, this isn't good news.
Anger is an easy emotion to turn to in the immediate aftermath of devastating news.
And our remarkable account, the Tammy Peterson story of incurable cancer, prayer, healing, and a Catholic conversion.
We need to partner with our families now in real intentional ways to form up these saints and scholars.
Celebrating Catholic Schools Week, a talk with a superintendent whose schools are thriving.
Everybody's here for one reason, Phil, and they want to talk about it. They want to talk about their adventure getting here, their trek. Everyone's made a trek, a pilgrimage.
And you know that groundhog named Phil? Well, we'll explain why his special day has such a close connection to Catholicism. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Our prayers continue to be with the families of the three American servicemen killed and attacked in the FOB in Jordan. They risked it all, and we'll never forget the sacrifices and service to our country.
During Thursday's National Prayer Breakfast, President Joe Biden honored three U.S. soldiers killed in a drone attack on a U.S. military outpost in northeast Jordan near the Syrian border. 46-year-old Sergeant William Rivers, 24-year-old Specialist Kennedy Sanders, and 23-year-old Specialist Brianna Moffat all died in the Sunday attack, and more than 30 other service members were injured. The remains of those soldiers, all three from Georgia, were brought back to the United States on Friday. President Biden attended the dignified transfer at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, where he met with the families privately before receiving the remains. U.S. officials say the drone was fired by Iran-backed militants and appeared to come from Syria. It reportedly arrived at the outpost just as an American drone was returning to base, allowing it to enter the airspace unchallenged. Iran has denied involvement in the attack. The Pentagon is promising strong multi-day, multi-location retaliation as many lawmakers on Capitol Hill call for swift action. Others acknowledge a delicate balance. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham issued a statement writing in part, "I'm calling on the Biden administration to strike targets of significance inside Iran." He goes on to say, "The only thing the Iranian regime understands is force. Until they pay a price with their infrastructure and their personnel, the attacks on U.S. troops will continue."
What the president is doing is being very careful about calibrating his response to be clear, decisive, but strategic. To say to Tehran, this behavior is not acceptable. We're not going to stand idly by if you kill U.S. troops. But at the same time, we're not going to instigate a war. Instigating a war in the Middle East would play right into our enemy's hands.
Any action the U.S. takes could further impact the Israel-Hamas war and broaden tensions in the Middle East. The fighting in the Israel-Hamas war continues on multiple fronts in Gaza. The Israeli military released footage on Thursday, it says, shows soldiers encountering the enemy and exchanging gunfire. The military also released video of airstrikes on Hamas targets. According to the Hamas-controlled territory's health ministry, more than 27,000 Palestinians have been killed and 66,000 wounded by Israel's offensive in Gaza. That offensive launched in the wake of the deadly Hamas terror attacks on October 7th that killed some 1,200 Israelis. President Biden has issued sanctions against four Israeli settlers for alleged acts of violence in the West Bank. The rare action comes under a new executive order Thursday against those responsible for violence in the wake of the Israeli invasion of Gaza. Ultimately, dozens of people could be impacted by the directive. The move comes as some Muslim and Arab Americans are upset that the Biden White House hasn't called for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Funding for the United Nations aid agency in Gaza is being pulled after Israel claimed some UN workers took part in the October 7th Hamas attack. The UN's Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, known by the acronym UNRWA, is the main organization providing aid for the men, women, and children who desperately need assistance in Gaza. At least half of UNRWA's top government donors have suspended funding, including the U.S., Canada, and many Central European countries.
The reports that we got last week, and UNRWA brought them to us, were deeply, deeply troubling. It is imperative that UNRWA immediately, as it said it would, investigate, that it hold people accountable as necessary.
So far, UNRWA has fired several staffers in the wake of the allegations. The agency is asking countries to reconsider pulling their funding. On Tuesday, Israeli special undercover forces made a dramatic raid inside a hospital in the West Bank, disguising themselves as women and medical workers to kill three Palestinian militants. Surveillance video from inside the hospital shows the Israeli forces carrying assault rifles, and the Israeli military says the militants were using the hospital as a hideout. It's alleged one of those targeted had transferred weapons and ammunition to others for a planned attack. There were no reports of other casualties in the raid. Israel is facing backlash for the raid amid hostage release negotiations. On Monday evening, 11 seriously injured children and babies from Gaza arrived in Rome for treatment in Italian hospitals. Four of the children will be cared for by Bambino Gesù Hospital, run by the Vatican. The injured children initially underwent triage aboard an Italian hospital ship. Guardians escorted the children to awaiting ambulances. Vatican's vicar to the Holy Land, Father Ibrahim Faltas, made a visit to the children at Bambino Gesù. No word on when other children might arrive. The victim of a deadly attack on a Catholic church in Istanbul, Turkey, was laid to rest on Monday. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility for the shooting at Santa Maria Church that took the life of a 52-year-old man. This video shows the two gunmen open the door for a white-haired man before they follow and shoot him in the back of the head. Officials say the gunmen fled when their weapons jammed after firing two rounds. Hours after the attack, Bishop Massimiliano Paniluro, the Apostolic Vicar of Istanbul, told EWTN News that the man was killed during the consecration while all the congregation was praying. The bishop also says the victim was not Christian.
The deceased was a close friend of ours. They have been attending for a few months and praying. Our churches are open to everyone. We welcome everyone that wants to pray. He was not Christian. He was not baptized. He was dear to us. We are really sorry for him, his family. We started praying and we'll keep going. The only thing we can do is pray.
The Turkish Minister of the Interior says police conducted raids on 30 locations across the city following the attack, arresting the two suspects and detaining dozens of others. The deadly attack comes after multiple arrests of suspected Islamic State members earlier this month, accused of plotting attacks on churches and synagogues across Turkey. On Sunday, the Holy Father offered his support for the community of Santa Maria Church after his weekly Angelus.
I express my closeness to the community of St. Mary Church in Istanbul, which during Mass suffered an armed attack with one dead and some wounded.
There are about 25,000 Roman Catholics living in Turkey, according to a 2022 report by the U.S. Department of State. Joining us now is Robert Nicholson, who has a background in law, Hebrew studies, and Middle Eastern history. He's the president and founder of the Philos Project, which seeks to promote positive Christian engagement in the Near East, and has discussed the Israel-Hamas war on his weekly podcast, The Deep Map. Robert, welcome back to News in Depth. Before we discuss Turkey, let's go back to the recent events in Jordan. Representative Moulton from Massachusetts praised the careful and calibrated response from the Biden administration on the drone attack and in its dealings with Iran. How is the U.S. perceived in the region, and is it too strong, too cautious?
The U.S. is perceived as extremely weak and not to be relied upon. And that is the view of both our friends and our enemies, sadly. What people don't understand is that these are not isolated events. It's not an attack in Jordan and Israel's war in Gaza and tensions in Lebanon and problems in the Red Sea. These are all part of one comprehensive strategy that is being coordinated out of Tehran, and it is a region-wide rebellion against the U.S., against Israel, and against our Arab allies in the region. Unfortunately, Iran is seen to be winning, and the United States, to the extent that we are too careful, too calibrated, not willing to push back, is understood to be rolling back its influence at the expense of Iran. And this is going to inflame conflict rather than mitigate it.
As you mentioned, Iran's influence in the region is not limited to the Palestinian territories and its backing of terrorist groups. The Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, was in Turkey last week to negotiate economic deals and increase bilateral relations. Why is Turkey such a critical regional partner?
Once upon a time, Turkey was a critical partner for the United States, but that ship has sailed. President Erdogan has been making it his job, really for the last 20 years, to pull Turkey out of the West and push it more toward the Islamic world, and specifically the Islamist part of the Islamic world. We are approaching next month the 100-year anniversary of the fall of the last caliphate, the Ottoman caliphate in the Middle East, and Erdogan and his Turkey is very much trying to bring that caliphate, that kind of Islamic politics, back. They, unfortunately, although a Sunni power, are willing to make peace and work together with Iran, a Shiite power, not because they love each other, they don't, but because they both agree on one thing, and that is rolling back, as I said, U.S. influence in the region, which they are both actively working to do even today as we speak.
Well, after the attack in a Catholic church in Turkey last weekend, the Bishop of Istanbul expressed concern that this deadly attack may not be the last, a little bit like what you're referencing. What are we seeing as far as interreligious tensions in Turkey or the impact of Iranian influence there?
Iranian influence and Turkish influence go together. They're different, but they are both intent on making the region very, very much the same. They are trying to change the region in their own likeness. Turkey itself is getting very bad. It has been now for a number of years. We saw the Hagia Sophia converted from a museum, used to be a church. Now it's a mosque. We are seeing increased persecutions of Turkey, not just through government policy, but as we've seen from the people, the spontaneous acts of terror. Turkey, of course, is a major funder and facilitator of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is causing trouble all over the region. And these days, and for a long time now, Turkey has been supporting Hamas. This is a pattern of behavior that we in the United States need to see, zoom out and see, and craft policies that curb their influence rather than make room for it to expand.
Well, Robert, you just mentioned Hamas. You're also an expert in Christian engagement in the Middle East, specifically with the people of Israel. Reports indicate six United Nations relief workers were part of the wave of Palestinian militants who killed 1,200 people in the deadliest assault on Jews since the Holocaust, and two of them helped to capture hostages. Does this affect the wave of accusations against Israel at the United Nations and pressure from the Biden administration?
It is the best kept secret, the worst kept secret, rather, in the region that the United Nations is actively working and has been for many years against the state of Israel on a number of fronts. This evidence that recently came out about UNRWA employees, and now the number is up to 12 or 13 people, not six, is just the evidence that we need to prove what we already know. Unfortunately, the UN and the Biden administration seem undeterred by the revelation that there are enemies within their own ranks and are, in fact, pressuring Israel, if you can believe it, pressuring Israel, the victim of the massacre of October 7th, to make concessions to the other side. It's unconscionable. It's absolutely wrong. And it's going to help the bad guys, embolden them, as they seek to grow at the expense of the good guys. This is a place where the United States, with not a whole lot of effort, could actually shift the needle the other way.
Well, the goal of the Israeli intervention here has been the release of the hostages. It's been 118 days since the hostages were taken, many with serious injuries. What do your contacts tell you about how likely any of them are still alive or that a release is possible?
My heart breaks for the hostages. There are 136 still there, men, women, children, even at least one little baby. The reports I've heard indicate that there are probably 20 to 30 of them already dead. Those who have been released, and there have been hostages who've been released, are now testifying to what they saw in those tunnels under the Gaza Strip, the wholesale maiming, mutilation, the raping, much raping of both men and women is going on all the time. And we need to be, as Christians, praying for them, as Americans, pushing our government to say the only thing that's important to say in this moment. It's not to Israel, it's to Hamas. Release the hostages and this war will end. That has been the message from day one, and it should have been a much more consistent message from the Biden administration. We need to get back to that, because that is the most important thing for anyone who cares about peace and the end of this war in Gaza.
Well, we're certainly praying for peace, but most of all for the families and the hostages. Thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you.
EWTN News in Depth correspondent Colin Flynn is currently in Turkey. And in the weeks ahead, we'll have a closer look at the state of the Christian Catholic Church there. And next week, Colin reports on the deadly earthquake a year ago that took more than 50,000 lives, how Catholic relief agencies are helping the region recover and rebuild. There's much more ahead on this episode of EWTN News in Depth. Tech leaders grilled on Capitol Hill about keeping our kids safe. It's National Catholic Schools Week. We talk enrollment and a miraculous story of survival after an incurable cancer diagnosis.
Well, the procedures were invasive and painful, but if I prayed the Lord's Prayer just constantly over and over, I could just get through the procedure.
Tammy Peterson shares the story of her cancer journey, from hopeless to healing, thanks to the power of prayer.
What a privilege and responsibility to be part of this journey with these families, with their children, their young people.
A Catholic school superintendent in Michigan shares his school's enrollment success story.
It's Groundhog Day here in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. Phil has made his weather prediction, and I'm Mark Irons with a Catholic backstory to Groundhog Day. That story coming up.
And later, we head to Pennsylvania for a little Catholic schooling about that groundhog. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back.
Your product is killing people. Will you set up a victim's compensation fund with your money, the money you made on these families sitting behind you? Yes or no?
One-third of fentanyl cases investigated over 5 months had direct ties to social media.
Lawmakers blasting social media CEOs on Capitol Hill Wednesday in a hearing on child internet safety. The rare bipartisan thrashing pressed tech leaders on the industry's alleged enabling of child sexual exploitation, election meddling, fake news, and drug abuse, which they say caused many young people to suffer and even die. Many of the lawmakers are intent on overturning a long-standing federal law that gives immunity to those companies from lawsuits over user-generated content and putting tough regulations in place. The tech bosses defended their platforms as parents who lost their children and blamed these companies for playing a role in their deaths packed the hearing while holding up pictures of their loved ones. Children's advocates and lawmakers say companies are not doing enough to protect them. In a heated question and answer session with Mark Zuckerberg, Missouri Senator Josh Hawley asked the founder of Facebook, whose company owns Instagram, if he has personally compensated any of the victims and their families for what they've been through.
Have you compensated any of the victims? These girls, have you compensated them?
I don't believe so.
Why not? Don't you think they deserve some compensation for what your platform has done? Help Senator, with counseling services, help with dealing with the issues that your service has caused?
Our job is to make sure that we build tools to help keep people safe.
Are you going to compensate them?
Senator, our job and what we take seriously is making sure that we build industry-leading tools to find harmful
content, make money,
take it off the services,
to make money,
and to build tools that empower parents.
Lawmakers pushed Mark Zuckerberg to stand up, face those families behind him, and apologize to those who say they were harmed by online content. Google's YouTube platform was notably missing from the list of companies called to the Senate hearing. YouTube is by far the most popular social platform used by teens, according to the Pew Research Center, with 93% using that service. This week is Catholic Schools Week, where educators, students, and parishes celebrate the value a Catholic education provides. They hold masses, open houses, and activities for students and families. The Catholic Church has a long history of providing education, especially in areas where there are no options to learn throughout the world. According to the National Catholic Education Association in the United States, there are more than 5,000 Catholic schools, most of which are elementary and middle schools. They also report a graduation rate of 98%, with 85% of graduates who go on to attend a four-year college. Enrollment in Catholic schools continues to tick up slightly, with an increase of just 0.3% this year over last year, staying on a two-year trend. In the Diocese of Lansing, Michigan, schools are celebrating 3 years of increased enrollment. I speak with the superintendent of schools in Lansing about their success. Superintendent Maloney, thank you so much for joining me. We know how busy you are with National Catholic School Week events this week. You wrote on the Diocese of Lansing's website that enrollment in your schools is up for a third straight year in a row, up 10% since 2020, an increase that you called unprecedented. What do you think is causing this growth?
Oh, well, we are so blessed, first and foremost, with an incredible leader in Bishop Boyer. And he's in his 16th year here of being Bishop of the Diocese of Lansing. And from day one, he was focused on the salvation of souls in his diocese, but also having strong parishes and strong schools. Mm. And so with that leadership, the superintendents before me focused on our school leaders. So we are so blessed with incredible, faithful, on-fire disciples who are excellent leaders. And you know, it's been a process. It's been probably over a decade that we have focused on renewing our Catholic schools in the Diocese of Lansing, and we're starting to see some real fruits of those efforts right now.
And in working on that renewal, what challenges have Catholic schools faced in Michigan? Are there any trends across the country that you and other superintendents are seeing that you're actually seeing lived out in a bigger way in Michigan?
Yeah, I think, in Michigan, our constitution is one of the most restrictive in terms of any aid coming to non-public schools, faith-based schools. And so, figuring out how to financially make our schools financially sustainable and viable is an ongoing challenge with rising costs. Recently, the challenge is attracting, retaining faithful Catholics to teach in our schools. So trying to create pipelines from within the diocese, but outside the diocese to with some of our great Catholic higher ed institutions to bring those faithful disciples our way. So I'd say, the financial stability and attracting teachers are two of the challenges, but we seem to be doing okay on both those fronts right now. But that will never go away and something we'll always have to continue to work on.
Absolutely, a work in progress. Are there any other challenges around gender ideology or any of the policies of the state that might bleed into your day-to-day?
Yeah, we're blessed once again with wonderful leadership. So, it was several years ago that we put out our gender policy from the diocese. And we also have a diocesan family school agreement that every family has to sign when they enroll in our Catholic schools. And they have to sign every year. And those policies make it clear who we are. Right. And who we and what we're about. So our families know when they come in that in word and deed that we're going to be teaching the fullness of the Catholic faith. And we want to partner with those parents. Right. The parents are the primary educators. And our job is to partner with them and their primary duty to educate, but also get their kids to heaven. And so it's a challenge. Yes. But honestly, those secular ideologies actually help us to make it clear who we are. The distinctions are clear. And so our families are choosing us because of those distinctions.
You mentioned primary educators, the parents, which is something that our church significantly teaches. They want that responsibility to be with the parents first. What does that look like within your schools?
Yeah, well, I think it looks like, first of all, we are blessed in our diocese with wonderful homeschool communities where those parents have been called by God to be the educators with their children on a day-to-day basis. And then for the rest of our families, they know that they need to partner with the church to provide this education. So I think it starts with that family school agreement, which is intentional to instruct our
our families, our parents, on their duty and how we're going to partner with them. Coupled with that, many of our parishes have a parish family covenant that lays out the expectations of families attending Mass, weekly Mass, daily prayer with their children, and also delineates what they can expect from the school. And so from the beginning of that relationship, when we bring families in, we're trying to help them understand their role as parents and help them understand how we can partner with them to help get their kids to heaven. We say we're all about forming that next generation of saints and scholars.
Oh, that's beautiful. Saints and scholars. Well, it sounds like you're doing a lot of that virtue and character building work that is the reported appeal for Catholic schools and for students and parents. How have students in your schools responded to that virtue and character building?
Yeah, I can remember when we implemented, we're so blessed in the Diocese of Lansing, we have right housed within our diocese the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Universe. And so we use their education and virtue program. And I remember being at a school and actually working summer camps with our elementary students at that time. And there was concern from us adults. Oh, my goodness, these children won't understand the words fortitude, magnanimity. And you know what? As we presented this to our young people, oh, my goodness, they embraced it. And they were able to explain it better than a lot of us adults. And so on this renewal journey, we just continue to rediscover the genius of the Catholic Church, right? The tried and true practices that have always been there that we kind of, for whatever reason, moved away from. And now we're renewing and re-grasping those beautiful things. And so all of our schools have a virtue program. These students, these young people, they understand their virtues. They can speak to them, whether it's in how they're behaving, whether it's in how they're interacting with their peers and with adults, and, of course, with our Heavenly Father. So we see that is a big, big part of our renewal.
Beautiful. Ever ancient, ever new, going back and forth from bringing with us our traditions. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's been a privilege.
Next, in her first extended television interview, Tammy Peterson shares the shock she and her husband, Jordan Peterson, felt when she received a fatal cancer diagnosis.
I stayed in the present. I just stayed with God in the present.
Tammy's prayers made the difference. We'll be right back.
We were in shock, though. You know, we were in shock. Jordan was in shock. He was with me. And I thought, well, you know, all my mother and all her family are dead. And they died in their 60s and 70s, you know. And I thought, maybe I've just inherited whatever is going on in my family, and oh well.
The cancer journey of Tammy Peterson. Diagnosed with a hopeless case of incurable cancer, the power of prayer brings her healing and leads her to Catholicism. Her family's international profile has brought extra attention to Peterson's remarkable story. But this is the first time Tammy Peterson has talked about it in an extended television interview. Correspondent Colin Flynn joins us from the EWTN Vatican Bureau to tell us more about this remarkable story about Tammy Peterson and the community, unlikely community around her that brought her to faith. Colin?
Monsi, it is great to speak to you. Now, this is an incredible story, an inspiring, miraculous story. Mm-hmm. And many of her viewers will not be familiar with the name Tammy Peterson, but they might know her husband, the world-famous and renowned psychologist Dr. Jordan Peterson. He's one of the most famous speakers in the world. But a few years ago, he announced the tragic news that his wife of over 30 years, Tammy Peterson, had been diagnosed with a very rare and deadly type of kidney cancer. There was no cure. There was a 0% chance of survival, and she was given 10 months to live. So as you can imagine, this was devastating news for Tammy, for Jordan, and for the entire family. She then connected with an old friend of hers, a lady who happened to be Catholic, a lady called Queenie, who, when she was in hospital, brought her a pair of rosary beads. Now, she had never prayed the rosary before, but she started. Fast forward to today, Monsi, her health is good, and she is cancer-free. She puts it down to not only prayer, but the novena for the sick and for the rosary, as you're about to hear. This is the first time she has sat down for an extended one-on-one interview in her home in Toronto, Canada. Bring us back to 2019, was it?
Yeah.
When you got that diagnosis.
Yeah.
You were sitting in your doctor's office, mm-hmm. and what did he tell you?
We went into his office and he started handing me papers to sign, and his hands were shaking, and I noticed his hands were shaking, and I thought, this isn't good news. It's something called a Bellini tumor. He said a Bellini tumor, they are very rare, and they grow so fast that the only way they're diagnosed is after someone's passed away. And so what you've got is going to kill you, and you're going to die in about 10 months.
Wow.
And I thought, well, you know, all my mother and all her family are dead, and they died in their 60s and 70s, you know, and I thought, maybe I've just inherited whatever is going on in my family, and oh, well, that's kind of how I thought. And then we were in shock, though, you know, we were in shock. Jordan was in shock. He was with me. And we came home to our street, and my son used to live in a house at the end of the street with his wife. So I told him, looks like I'm not going to get better. Looks like I have something that's going to kill me in 10 months. And I saw the grief in his eyes, which was way more grief than I had for myself. There was no comparison. And it reflected back on me. And when I saw it, I realized that I was worthy. I was worthy of staying alive or fighting for my life anyway.
But maybe it was too overwhelming. Because
it was definitely too overwhelming.
Less than a year, 10 months left on this planet.
Right.
I mean, your mind, do you think, why me?
No, I didn't think why me. I thought, oh yeah, me. That's what I thought. I really didn't put up any defense or questioning at all until I saw my son. And then I felt this extreme peace just fill me. And a knowledge that I didn't have before. And I said to my son, you know, that doctor, he's a man. He has an opinion. Maybe he's right, but maybe he's not right. The only way we'll know is God, because God will decide when I'm going to die.
That statement, only God will know, God knows when we're going to die. Did that come from your background, a religious background, or a spirituality?
When I was a baby, I was baptized. I prayed before I went to sleep when I was a little kid. I went to Sunday school. But I was the youngest of four, and by the time I was 12, all my siblings had left home, and I quit going to church. I was turning into a teenager who wanted to experiment and go do things and find out what life was about.
So you have the diagnosis, you're in hospital, you believe you only have months to live, and no one survives this cancer. But you start to pray, particularly the rosary.
Well, I started to pray right away after that day, but it wasn't very long that they put me back in the hospital, because they needed to get me back there quick to do the surgery, because there wasn't any radiation or chemo or anything, because they don't treat this cancer. There was no treatment for it, so just surgery. So they got me back in very quickly to do surgery. I think within a couple of weeks I was back in the hospital. And I had the surgery. The night before the surgery, we did a very deep prayer. They did the surgery, it went very well. And then I started convalescing. And I went home. And within a week, my legs started to fill up with fluid. And they had got the cancer, but it turns out that they had missed some of the lymph, and so it was draining. And so my life forces were draining into the lower parts of my body first. But I was slowly filling up, because it was my feet, my lower legs, and then my thighs. And I went to see the doctor. He saw me and he said, go to emergency right now. And they siphoned off 9 liters of fluid.
Wow, nine liters.
They'd never siphoned off that much fluid, but I wasn't getting any better. I was wasting away. So they put me in the hospital again, and that's when That's when Queenie emailed me, I guess. I don't remember, but she emailed and asked if she could come. She showed up and she had two rosaries that were blessed by the Pope, and she said, would you like to pray the rosary? And I was like, yeah, I would. And she said, do you know the rosary? And I said, well, I do, but I don't know how to pray the rosary. So she came every day for 5 weeks.
That is incredible. And she would pray the rosary decade by decade with you and explain the glorious mysteries. And
absolutely.
What did you think when you held the rosary beads, when you were praying the Hail Marys, when you were going through the rhythm of the rosary?
Well, the rhythm, I think, was it was calming for me because, you know, when I was talking to her, I was talking about my mother was already passed away, but I would have been leaving my father, who was like 90 at the time, my sisters, my brothers, my husband, my children, my friends. I was leaving everybody, and so I was talking about those kind of things. But also, she would say, "Who do you want to pray for at the beginning of each mystery? What's your intention?" And I would say my intention, and then, but it would take me, I don't know, I can remember talking a lot, probably took me 20 minutes to say my intention before then we would pray. But, you know, the prayer was enough to take me from this long, drawn-out meditation into these people that I loved and was going to miss, to bringing it back to a place where I was paying attention, but in a very rhythmical, methodical way. So I think that in that way it was good, because without the rhythm of the Hail Marys, and also you're touching beads too, so that keeps you present.
Was it making you more comfortable with the reality you were facing of death, of the afterlife?
Oh yeah, for sure. I didn't have any fear. I wouldn't let the fears of the next day or whatever was coming bother me. I would just pray. And I continue to do that now. I don't let myself worry.
And you pray the novena for the sick as well, I believe.
I did. That was very at the end when they finally found out there was a doctor in Pennsylvania that might have been able to help me. And it was on the fifth day of praying those prayers that the leak in my lymph system closed up.
When the leak closed up, Tammy, what did the doctor say to you? What was the reaction from the medical professionals?
So I was sitting out having breakfast, and their eyes got big, and they said, you're better. And I went into the hospital, and they pulled out all, and within half an hour, I was out of the hospital. And then they phoned me every week for a month, and at the end of the month, they said, you're better. Goodbye. Good luck.
Isn't it incredible, from being told originally in the office with the doctor's handshaking that you had a terminal cancer, 10 months to live, and the operations and the complications and the leak, to be told, okay, you're better.
Yeah. Right.
What do you put it down to?
Well, you know, earlier in June when I was back in the hospital again with this more serious problem, my husband was just beside himself. And I felt sorry for him. And I wanted to save him some of the pain that he was feeling. And so I just... What can I say? And the idea, the thought, I guess, would maybe it was a prayer, right? Maybe it was a prayer that I prayed because I wanted to help my husband. I said, you know, I'll be back at it by August 19th. It's our anniversary. And that day that I stopped the leak was our anniversary. And so why did it do that on that day? Why was it that day? Because that was the day, that was our anniversary, our 32nd anniversary. And everyone, my husband, my son was there with his wife, my sister-in-law and her kids were there, and everybody was just blown away that is what happened that day. I was blown away that that's what happened that day.
You have decided to convert to Catholicism.
Yeah.
Join the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Why?
Why? Well, you know, I don't know. You know, when I was a little kid, I used to miss, in the Protestant church, I used to miss Mother Mary, anything about her. And maybe it was a feminist thought. I don't know. There was some feminism in my family. Maybe that's what that was. But something about it, it was, you know, they had a portrait of Jesus Christ up there. That was good. We had prayers and everything. But there was just, I don't know, something. I felt like there was something missing. And then later I found out that my great-grandmother was Catholic and that my grandmother changed our religion to United. And so when I was better, one of my cousins phoned me and said, oh, she didn't know I was sick. She was sorry to hear I was sick. And she said, I'm going to send you something. And so we went on tour. And when we came back, we had a lot of mail. Mm-hmm. And I went through the mail and I found her letter. And in her letter, I found this rosary. And this was my great-grandmother's rosary. She carried it with her always. And so now it would be like 150 years old,
wow.
I suppose.
Wow.
And then she gave it to my grandmother when she died. And my grandmother gave it to my aunt. And my aunt died and gave it to my cousin. And now my cousin's given it to me.
Tammy, as we look at you today, you look great. You sound great. Since we came in here, you've been smiling. We've been joking. You've been laughing. How is life? How are you feeling? How is your health?
My health is good. I've had scans regularly. There's nothing there. So I'm good. I'm good.
Finally, Tammy, when you look to the future, I know you have two children, mm-hmm. four beautiful grandchildren. Mm-hmm. What are your dreams and hopes for the future?
Well, really, I believe that they have good intentions and that their hearts are in the right place. And so, you know, I hope all the best for them and their children, you know, and that they find the courage and strength they need for life's trials, because there will be trials. And I hope that Jordan and I can continue to speak the truth, to try to tell the stories that we're inspired to tell, and hope that that can be of some help to people who are listening. That's really what it's all about.
Tammy, it's an incredible story. It's an inspirational one, and thank you so much for sharing it with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Such an incredible story, a miraculous story. And what I loved, Monsi, was that, as she saw in the interview at the end, she showed us she still has the rosary beads, her grandmother's rosary beads, in her pocket. And she told us that she prays the rosary every day out on her porch.
That's so beautiful. It's really, like you said, a remarkable story of faith and a great model for our audience, for those who are curious about when they can pray the rosary, those who think that they have to be in the church to start praying the rosary. Our Blessed Mother's intercession has no limits. Thank you for bringing us that story, Colm. And we'll be back in a moment with some thoughts from Jordan about his wife's miraculous recovery. Tammy Peterson and husband Jordan Peterson struggle with what appears to be her hopeless cancer diagnosis and a prognosis of just 10 months to live. Our story of faith, prayer, and healing continues. Receiving the worst medical news possible, the Petersons together face the horrible news and terrible odds. With the help of a friend, Tammy turns to daily prayer, reciting the Lord's Prayer to get through painful procedures, and the rosary, which brings her solace and comfort. I'm joined once again by my colleague, Colm Flynn, who tells us about his conversation now with Jordan. Colm?
Monsi, Jordan Peterson is Tammy's husband. He is one of the most famous psychologists and public speakers in the world, quite a controversial figure as well. And in the interview with him again at their home in Canada, I was able to ask him about his reaction to his wife's devastating diagnosis of having that kidney cancer. And what I was surprised at was that Jordan spoke in such a vulnerable way. And then also to hear his thoughts on what she puts her recovery down to a miracle, more or less. To hear his thoughts on that was quite extraordinary. Mm. And here is a little sneak preview of that interview.
Anger is an easy emotion to turn to in the immediate aftermath of devastating news. So, and grief is an emotion, or terror even, is an emotion that takes a longer while to settle in.
And terror, terrified of the inevitable that you were going to lose your wife of 35 years.
Well, when you lose someone, when you lose your wife, you don't just lose your wife. You lose the future that you had conjured up and conceptualized. You lose your children's mother. You lose, I would lose a friend, a great friend, and so that in itself obviously turns things upside down. We switched very rapidly into active mode, I would say, and started traveling around from physician to physician, hospital to hospital, as we were fortunate to be able to do.
Did you and Tammy talk about death, about her dying?
No, not really. We were so concerned with immediate emergency practicalities that the more metaphysical aspect of things never arose. And one of the things you need to do when you're confronted by dreadful news is to shorten your time frame immediately. Otherwise, it's overwhelming, right? So if the thoughts of the next year or 5 years are inconceivably threatening, then you concentrate on the next week, and if that's too much, then the next day, and you can get to the point, if you're really unfortunate, where you concentrate on the next minute.
The full interview with Dr. Jordan Peterson is quite remarkable, and many people might see him in a light that they've never seen him before. A very real and vulnerable side of Jordan when talking about his wife and the journey that she is on towards the Catholic faith. So the full interview, you won't want to miss it here on EWTN News in Depth.
Monsi? That's certainly the signature Colm Flynn take, is to get people to share their faith with the rest of us. Thank you so much for that, Colm. EWTN News in Depth will air an extended version of the Jordan Peterson interview on our February 16th program, with an encore airing on February 18th. More on his reaction to Tammy's cancer battle and how prayer helped her. And he shares some thoughts on organized religion.
You can't go to the North Pole and see Santa Claus load a sleigh. You can come to Punxsutawney and watch Phil predict the weather.
A favorite event on the American calendar, February's Groundhog Day, is really a custom grounded in Catholic tradition. We'll explain what Catholicism has to do with it when we return.
February 2nd is Groundhog Day. Every year, Punxsutawney Phil predicts if winter will be long or short, depending on whether or not he emerges from his burrow and sees his shadow. America's commemoration of Groundhog Day goes back to more than a century. And believe it or not, its origins are based on Catholic tradition. We sent reporter Mark Irons to Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, to find out more.
It's Punxsutawney Phil!
The crowd roars for a rodent who predicts the weather. Thousands of people come from everywhere.
Where are you from?
I'm from Utah.
We're from New Orleans.
You came from Canada?
Yep.
Early this morning, they all huddled together as they do every year to wait for Punxsutawney Phil's prediction. He emerged from his burrow and did not see his shadow, which means
an early spring is on the way!
It's just another Groundhog Day in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. The town, known for a forecasting groundhog named Phil and made famous by a movie with actor Bill Murray, is wildly popular once a year.
For the groundhog!
For the groundhog!
Yeah, Phil, 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 Phil
But did you know there is a Catholic connection to Groundhog Day?
I didn't.
Did not. No idea.
That's right, a Catholic connection. This seemingly random and secular celebration involving a large rodent and plenty of festive fun takes place every year on February 2nd. But after a little digging, you'll find that faith burrows deeper into this tradition. Way before rodent prognostications, liturgical celebrations got most of the attention. On February 2nd, the Catholic Church celebrates the presentation of the Lord, remembering when Mary and Joseph brought Jesus to the Jewish temple for consecration after his birth. The Gospel account speaks of a righteous man named Simeon who made a prophetic statement about Jesus, calling him a light for revelation to the Gentiles and glory for your people Israel. In Catholic tradition, the presentation has also been celebrated with Candlemas, when people bring their candles to church for a blessing, symbolizing the divine light of Christ dispelling darkness, just as Simeon had once predicted. But in medieval times, Candlemas would develop another layer of lore. As January turned to February and farmers began to think about growing crops for the spring, predictions about the weather were made based on the presence of sunlight or darkness on Candlemas Day. Many European folk rhymes passed down through the centuries document this.
If Candlemas be fair and bright, winter has another flight. If Candlemas brings clouds and rain, winter will not come again.
Tom Curry, a founder of the Punxsutawney Historical Association, hopes people will find what he has. There's a lot more to February 2nd.
Maybe they'll become curious like I was, to kind of look at their own faith and look back and think about Groundhog Day other than a day of a bunch of people celebrating an animal.
The animal-centered modern-day celebration can be traced centuries back to Germany. There, the liturgical tradition of Candlemas, coupled with the weather predictions, would somehow further evolve, developing fur and four legs. In some historical folklore accounts, badgers were the original weather prognosticators of Candlemas Day.
A lot of the people don't know the history of how it got here.
As Europeans settled in America, they carried over the tradition, and it would evolve even more.
It's Groundhog Day!
The badgers were replaced by Pennsylvania abundant groundhogs.
If Candlemas Day is bright and clear, there'll be two winters in the year.
And the old folk rhymes, now recited in a different style on Gobbler's Knob every year in Punxsutawney, where Phil and his shadow, or lack thereof, indicate what's to come.
But what this weather did not provide is a shadow or reason to hide. Glad tidings on this Groundhog Day!
You won't hear much proclaimed about the presentation of the Lord or Candlemas Day. But lest you think the Catholic connections to Groundhog Day are long gone, the faith still lives on in many of the key players.
You're the person who lifts Phil up every Groundhog Day.
It starts with the bearded man holding Phil as the crowd roars.
I'm lucky enough to get to hang out with this famous guy for my tenure.
A.J. DeRoom is Punxsutawney Phil's handler, and he's also Catholic. And so are a number of the other top hat-wearing men who make up this Groundhog's posse, Phil's inner circle.
There's always been a good, strong Catholic contingency in Punxsutawney.
And among Phil's super fans, you might find someone like lifelong Catholic Jeannie Curtis.
What does Punxsutawney Phil mean to you?
Well, he's the one and only original groundhog, and we celebrate him.
For all the famous people her favorite groundhog has met, she hopes he can meet one more.
Hasn't seen the Pope yet, but maybe one of these days.
No audience with the Pope just yet, but Phil did make an important stop before capturing global attention on Gobbler's Knob center stage this year. He visited the kids at the only Catholic school in Punxsutawney, Saints Cosmas and Damien, the same one his buddy AJ attended as a kid.
Their eyes light up when they see Phil. It's just so much fun, and you get to explain to them why this groundhog is such an important thing to our town.
The truth is, Phil brings in a lot of money for local businesses on Groundhog Day, and some of that money turns into generous donations that help fund this Catholic school and pay for students' education.
Our kids come here with scholarships that pay upwards of 90% of their tuition, and that is all money given from local businesses to keep the school open and accessible for families.
Heather Kunzelman, the principal at Saints Cosmas and Damien, says the goal here is to lead young students to God. And Phil, the famous local groundhog, is helping in that mission. His visits bring smiles.
Here at our school, the biggest thing we focus on is finding joy in our faith. And what a fantastic way to do that with the addition of the groundhog.
From the past to the present and likely into the future.
Any predictions?
It's safe to say you can't take the Catholic out of Groundhog Day. Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
Okay, folks, Punxsutawney Phil predicts we're going to have a short winter. Let's see whether he's right. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. See you then.